In 1971, the Los Angeles performance art scene was flourishing. Chris Burden had just ordered a studio assistant to shoot him in the arm with a rifle. Barbara T. Smith was stuck to the wall of her gallery with electrical tape. Paul McCartney was painting his naked body with ketchup in the name of art. And Bob Parks was walking the streets of LA in a string bikini. Their work went on to be collected by the biggest museums and institutions in the world. They all saw their art sell for millions.
$3,050,000. Thank you.
Except Bob. Bob moved back to England to live with his mother and father.
Hello, it's Bob. Are you around here?
In the late 60s, it was either sex or self-mutilation were choices. And I went with sex because it was safer.
There's all sorts of artists. You can't rule anybody out.
That's me in a sexual position in Miriam. Well, that's Mum as an angelic force.
He was very animated, used his hands a lot and his body a lot.
But you know, me and art,
yes,
it's been all my life, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
And you've been with me all the time, haven't you, with that?
Yes.
I'm a pacifist, I don't have violence, physical violence. Vocally, I get very violent, and Mum's received it all her life.
Because I'm still in love with Miriam, I know that. Presumably, she must have fallen out of love with me.
What do you think about death? Have you got any thoughts about it?
I'm looking forward to it.
Do you want to say anything about the incidental?
I wrote a little poem. I just wanted to read that out.
Sure.
What's it called? I've just killed my mum in a car crash.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And once again, we welcome Bob Parks back to the studio.
Hi.
Good afternoon, Bob. Thank you for coming in again. We opened the programme with a trailer for your forthcoming film.
The R&B Feeling.
The R&B Feeling. Uh-huh. Is that the name of the film?
It is.
Okay. And that's a sort of two-minute trailer available on Vimeo.
Yeah.
The whole film is shot by Marcus Head and Nathaniel Mellers. Artist Nathaniel Mellers. And in that clip, I'm actually there for about half a second.
Yeah.
I get my profile and there's a bit of a previous Resonance programme.
That's it.
Interesting clip of your mother where she says, I think you ask her, are you looking forward to death or something?
No, I said, what do you think about death? We did a forum on death.
Right.
And it followed that, I think.
Yeah, okay.
I'm looking forward to it.
Are you looking forward to it?
Me?
Yeah.
I don't know. Who knows? Yeah, that's right. Something to do, isn't it?
Let's hope so. Yeah.
Something not to do.
So what have you got in store for us today?
Yeah, right. Well, it's I'll run through it. It's just a redefinition of the whole of Western art. Is that all right?
Okay.
Okay, it's about a page.
Yeah.
And as you know, I'm doing this essay on from Gustav Moreau to Kazimir Malevich, the unexplored side of totalitarianism.
Right.
And I've got about, I don't know, two-thirds of the way in the first two programmes, and this is the end of volume one, I guess, so it's just the start. So what I'll do in this, I'll read this last page, which is page 101, out, and then I'll try and get as much out of the rest in before the end of the programme. I don't know how it's going to go, but we'll just see. Is that all right?
Absolutely. You can just go straight into it. I mean, I'll try not to interrupt you, occasionally sort of launch it.
And there'll be some stops when I can't read my own writing. So.
Right. Is that right?
Okay. Okay. And there might be some senior moments as well when I forget where I am.
Well, we know that's going to happen.
Okay. Here we go. This is approximately the history of Western art, in a sense, starting with Greek art, which was about consciousness, as a development from prehistoric times when art was about the subconscious or instinct and intuition. The role of the black... Sorry about that noise I make when I take my breath in, but
that's all right.
You can't see it. The role of the black voice, because I'm very interested in that blues and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I'll go on to say that. Is in that it affected this transition through Egyptian art, which is the spiritual component as an element from the start, as an active component in this process, i.e. the development from caveman art to Greek art. And so the role of Egyptian art was it wasn't like the European, but actually it was African and so on. Mm-hmm. And it comes in and out of the whole essay. The next stage, I'm coming forward a couple of thousand years, the next stage with the Impressionists, where art became about life, i.e. what they saw, the subtext switching from thoughts to words. So it was the subconscious, your intuition, and that they were your thoughts. But then the Impressionists started using words and saying things, you see. And the Symbolists introduced the spiritual component, which through Cézanne, as its main mover, he was the first guy who did like metaphysical he was the first artist who painted what he painted didn't look like what he was painting, and he was actually trying to directly affect brain processes rather than do a visual. So use the visuals in order to stimulate the brain rather than the eye, the optical thing directly. So with as the main mover, and as Sisley, what's his name?
Monet?
Surat. Surat, and Van Gogh. Mm-hmm. Van Gogh. And Gauguin. With Malevich, instead of art as life, which is what I just said, it became life as art. And the switch here, as the subtext, being the move from words to colours. So what the Impressionists did, instead of it being a narrative, which it was up to then, or history painting, whatever you want to call it, even through the Renaissance, where there was a degree of humanistic belief where it sort of became increasingly secularised, colours became what it was about, the dominant theme. It was about the mark. So narrative to the mark as the transition to the 20th century from the 19th century. Now, with the digital revolution, we are seeing the move from life as consciousness. Seeing the move from life as art to consciousness as art. The switch as subtext being thoughts replacing colours as the palette. So it's thoughts on one side of the equation now. It was on the other side in the advent of of humanity or whatever it was, life on Earth. Consciousness as art is mass psychosis. I'm comparing the two as the same thing. In the hands of D'Annunzio. Now, there were two... It took probably quite a lot of different branches out of symbolism. This idea of totalitarianism. And D'Annunzio was a big Italian poet, but also the inspiration of Mussolini and worked with Marinetti, but he was sort of the founder of fascism. And
You're saying D'Annunzio was the founder of fascism?
He was, yeah.
Okay.
Well, this book, The Pike, claims that anyhow, where he took totalitarians after the fin de siècle positions itself. It's the unexplored side of totalitarianism, which was the course that Malevich took. Now, for me, I'll explain what I'm saying instead of reading it literally. The idea, the scientific equation is... Sorry.
That's all right.
Scratch your nose and it hit the thing.
Scratch the mic.
Scratch the mic, yeah. Didn't risen. So what the idea is, there's one thing that comes from totalitarianism is power. And on the other hand, there also comes energy. And the scientific equation is that, I think it's this way, I might be the wrong way around. power equals time over energy. That's roughly the scientific equation. So there's a energy loss component in that equality. So I'm taking the way to implement power is through force. So that's the approach that D'Annunzio took out of totalitarianism. The way to enforce energy is through enthusiasm, which is the cause.
Was D'Annunzio actually interested in politics as such?
Yeah, very much
he was
so.
A poet, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, he took over what was then Rijeka. He established it as a fascist state.
Did he?
Yeah,
okay.
With force, he went in there and killed everyone.
Really?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it was his claim to fame.
When was this, roughly?
Before the Second World War.
Yeah.
I don't know.
30s.
Late 20s, early 30s, uh-huh. Yeah, sort of thing. Now, through the 20th century, we have travelled with D'Annunzio's heritage. He's been the one who's handed down what totalitarianism has become, because he's been the main voice. Well, someone said that it's a sociology lecturer at art school said that the 19th century produced Darwin, Marx and Freud, original thinkers, but all the 20th century's come up with is fascism. Uh-huh. So we've seen that, and you see it into corporate capitalism right now, and I'm going to go on to how it's capitalist abstraction. But in order to claw back to fin de siècle thinking, because that was the big time, and I'm calling fin de siècle kind of a larger from 1880 to 1920, quite a big span rather than immediately before and after. The opinion of art historians seems to be divided that you either can or you can't through some sort of time warp insert a bygone era into contemporary life. So what I'm saying, we've got to literally go, because the First World War saw the end of original thinking, basically, because people became scared, to death. If thinking produces such a stupid thing as war, I don't want to think anymore. So there hasn't been any original. I mean, it's easy to do original, but there just literally hasn't been any. So we need to get back to that time when we lost the thread, so to speak. And it's my belief that you can do this, but this is where the black voice comes in. Just as the symbolists gave the breakthrough to the impressionists, a spiritual dimension, which was the way that, I think Cezanne said of Monet, he's just an eye, but my God, what an eye. He gave a broader base, a structure. He went back to Poussin and got the Plato's series of form to give it a structure. But also the spiritual dimension gave it an ability to see it as a painting, but not as a painting. It's sort of as a surface that you could manipulate. But you could do it not through a design, through the literal marks, but it's what the marks signify, could have an effect on brain functioning, so that there would be... Well, it came in the 70s, this idea of paradigm shifts of consciousness. So he was essentially trying to affect shifts of consciousness before it got described into words. So in order to retrieve the lost utopianism of abstraction, because that's what they say, that was an era, now we've got sort of rather cynical about abstraction, and the modern movement itself. But I think by time warping back, I'm going to go on to say how we need to see this sort of time warp re-injection of the spiritual through the black voice, because they know about love. The process would be mass psychosis. This is the idea that I'm coming up with, but not as we've experienced it through power and force. And I've, as you know, in mental illness, I've had 30 years of psychosis, been to psychotherapy. And it's a very thin line, actually, between psychosis and normality, the crossover line. Just roughly the idea that we're at such a peak, well, very almost like Cuba right now, that the transition or the breaking through from normality to psychosis with people's dependency on the computer, if that were to break down, people would just go right over the edge. Somebody said Norman Mailer said America's a nation of psychotics. Anyhow, generalising, so some people are already there, sort of thing, but not necessarily. Through the, and I'm saying this is a good thing, but instead of through power and force, through energy and enthusiasm, and that's, you can think about charisma, and you can think about entertainment. I mean, I was like on the platform for Pellini at the Royal Festival Hall as a job as a host. And the way people stood up and you were shouting, you know, you could be at a Hitler youth rally on the receiving end of that. There's not a lot of difference between the vicariousness of the enjoyment of movies and the mass hypnosis of a power march, like so it's
it requires a willing audience, doesn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yep. A compliant me. Yep. So it's the blackness, which automatically comes with the spiritual component. So the black culture brings the spiritual as a part of it. So I'm suggesting a scenario initially through a movie. This is the idea. And I want to, because like, what's it? Oh, Christ, what's his name? Nathaniel has established his art reputation through his movie. And I think his director was Marcus. So obviously they've got a lot injected. And Marcus, his studio structure is he's funded by the commercial ads that he does. But really, his heart is in the possibility of feature films. So they've got a lot lying on that. So I've really got to present this well. And what I wanted to do was to present the idea. I wanted to call the feature film Mass Psychosis.
Oh.
And it's the idea, putting this idea forward, which I'm going to come on to.
Are you saying that the movie itself that you're making is a mass psychosis?
Well, I'm going to come on to say about the vicariousness of the cinematic experience, to my sensibility, is the perfect canvas for mass psychosis, or you could say propaganda. And just as Easy Rider was assimilated into the 60s, which was accompanied by the sexual revolution, I see this as being on the forefront of what the net of the what the sexual revolution promised was supposed to lay the ground for, which generations X's thinking, i.e. the spiritual revolution. So the idea that with the digital, this idea of psychosis, my idea of psychosis is the idea that coal tar was a waste product, and then until they re-perceived it as, and it funded the whole petrochemical industry. So instead of becoming a waste product, it's half the world was energized by it. And similarly, stress is a byproduct of anxiety. And as computers are moving into neurospace or neurology, it's like consciousness really is where it's happening now, where a lot of focus, certainly with the development of computers, is around, and the people, the entrepreneurs who are in Silicon Valley, who are engineering ideas that have an enormous worldwide appeal. And I go on to all of this, that the media for it no longer is external power, but it's internal power. And to try to pull those forces is frontier work, really, or to think of wanting to employ them, not as waste and dissipation of energy, but how to canalize the energy into what the forefront of consciousness. And anyway, I'll go on to it here. So I've got to sell that idea, and what it is, Miriam, my ex-wife from, I don't want to go too much into it because she doesn't like to be talked about in terms of her ideas, because she'd like to represent that for herself. So I miss out the last little bit of this. So it's the idea that I want to present it to her. We're going, before we see Tom's coming over from Australia, she's coming over from Puerto Rico.
Tom is?
My brother.
Right.
And they're both in the movie anyhow as well. And I wanted to present it, senior moment, hang on a minute. Okay. I want to present it. Just talk among yourselves out there.
I can't nudge you along. I don't know where you're going.
No, right, don't worry. Okay,
you're going to present the film. What you mean, in a preview screening or something?
It's coming up. Yeah, on the 2nd of May.
Right.
And that's it. I got it. Thank you.
Okay.
When we go to, as a sort of preamble, we're going to go to Vézelay. I've always wanted to go there in France. I've got like a somewhere booked in Dover. So we go straight from the flight and then drive straight there. Have a couple of days there through Airbnb. We've got a nice place. And then a couple of days in Paris. Well, what we had done, I probably cover it in here, so I miss it out when I get to there, if I get to there. I don't know, about 2 years ago, as part of the movie, I decided, you know, the death was a subject that the Generation X were sort of beginning to demystify. Now they'd done the job on sex. So we had a forum on death as part of the film, and we went out to the Gao Peninsula to conceptualise what we were going to bring to the thing. We had various other people from Generation X and friends and people like that. It's probably in the film. I don't know if it is. It might be. It might not. But then I want to bring it to Miriam, because she's good politically and stuff like that, to get her advice on how best to approach Marcus, because they've got a lot at stake for their investment in their lives, their creative identities, i.e. Marcus is setting up this film company basically to support creative endeavours through commercial, and he's got the knack of doing it, and Samuel. So if I ask them then to come on board on something like this...
What is it you're asking them to come on board to?
I don't know what it is, what you'd call it. I don't know if it's co-directorship. I don't think it is, but I think it's just... Well, actually, there was somewhere in Hollywood I once heard where they talk about films at a very raw... Because what happens in films in Hollywood, for example, is that an idea will put that out and then it'll get shot down, you know, and then that will get then shot down. But so at core... When it comes out, it has to be extraordinarily graphic and very extreme, because they know it's going to get shorn and everything. I just love to have been a fly on the wall in one of those meetings, because, you know, what we see in the horror films and that are quite... So the point is, I want to present it at a conceptual level with Mark and get their interest to see whether they'll come on board. And there's another one I want to get, John Duncan. He was the one who I was in the performance group with, who... bought the dead woman in Tijuana and had sex with her and had a vasectomy and then disappeared to Bologna. And so he's
he bought a dead woman
in TJ.
Right.
And they had the vasectomy to get rid of the bad seed. And
okay.
But he took my epileptic fit and had the police fashioning down the door on the radio program, actually, at that time.
Who took the epileptic fit?
John did. He pinched my idea, because that's what I had, this idea of self-abandonment. And
so you were having an epileptic fit?
No, I was. It was at art school. It was a thing, just the self, just making as much noise as would come out of the mouth. And it was out of John Cage and all that kind of stuff back then.
Right.
So it was just, you know, so all that. So, all right. So shall I get back?
You seem to be suggesting...
Oh, I know why I thought now with you, because you're into films, aren't you?
Yes.
Sort of, and I thought... The viability or the possibility, because the idea is of mass psychosis, using actually the medium of the experience in the cinema to change people's minds, which it does anyhow. If they're enjoying a film, they'll come away, oh, they'll make a good film, and it'll have an impact. But, you know, just to affect them psychologically, you know, so it's sort of like, I would imagine Hitler's propaganda films did, or they were aimed at doing, to affect people's in a totalitarian system, only not... for force and power, but for enthusiasm and energies. You know, it's the same idea, but using it for a different end, sort of thing. And I'm just asking you about the viability of this concept. You know, now in this moment on air.
Do you know Kenneth Anger's films?
Yeah.
Right.
Fireworks.
Yeah.
Scorpio Rising.
One of his apparent supposed theories is that he's sort of casting a spell on the audience with his films.
Yeah.
It's a sort of, you know, it's a...
It worked, actually, that person.
It's a conduit for his...
Yeah, it's an extension of that.
Philosophy.
And that as a sort of a halfway house to actual society. So the sort of using a movie as a tryout... before you go kind of public. And I mean, I don't know quite, and I have no idea what the film would be about or anything like that, but it's the underpinning idea that if they were interested, next stage would be then to get together and talk about it, and then if that would produce something and so on.
So you're proposing another film, basically.
A feature film this time.
Another film.
Much more ambitious.
Beyond your documentary.
Oh, yeah, no, that's just...
With
that's
the
just,
input of Tom and Miriam.
You.
And me.
As creative advisors with... you know, the people who would be actively involved would be, presumably, so, Nathan, Marcus, and Nathaniel, or whatever, and John, just to get to see whether we can get it into the possible. I mean, because you'd be talking about millions of pounds here. So right. This film isn't. Yeah. I don't know how much has been involved. I mean, it's 70 people.
It's the object to somehow bring about mass psychosis through this film.
Through the film, yeah. But this is the idea. I want to talk over with Miriam first, who's a psychiatric nurse, to see if I can con them into coming along with the idea when we get the opening of the private view, you know, for this film.
Right.
And I want to use the example. So it's using the moment and the immediacy of the moment to see if you can grasp people's attentions. And
yes, but what's the intention of inducing mass psychosis? What's the end result?
Well, someone, when I was at art school, described me... No, it was after art school. I got in with G.S. Fraser. He invited me on his MA course in Modern English American Literature, and he described me as one of the last romantic Stalinists.
Right.
So I've had a kind of like a totalitarian system running inside me my whole life. I mean, I'm a pacifist. I wouldn't implement it. I wouldn't impose it on anyone else.
It sounds like you want world power or something.
I wouldn't extend it beyond my own being.
You want to be a dictator.
In essence, but as I say, as I'm a pacifist, I haven't found a way to apply that.
Right.
I don't believe there's anything wrong. I mean, the idealism from our era was world government, which is an extension of that idea, which seems to have gone right out of fashion or never talked about. But it's that sort of thinking, yeah. If you want to call it dictatorship, but that's got a very negative word. I think there's a very positive term that's unexplored because people are terrified by that, because people have come up through totalitarian systems and have people killed and so on.
Yes.
But it would have a different shape. But as an original idea of the 20th century, I don't think, and this is what this essay is doing, it's unfolding actually whole worlds of unexplored thinking that, as a consequence of the First World War and the direction that society was going up to Van der Sierkle, was leading to this sort of development, a natural, and it just came to an abrupt halt. So it's my belief, what's coming out, and I went to like a forum on abstraction and society, for example, which come into this following the Malevich thing, is what's happened to abstraction as a consequence. It's been taken over by capitalism, and it's become a tool of the establishment. And society, life is abstraction now, and I have to argue that it's moved into the realm. But it's because it's only been half applied, because it's thwarted. People have, you know, unless the thing with my approach is spiritual, which is 100%. And if you don't like, it's everything or nothing. It's not a, like Cézanne, for example, who took Einstein's theory of atomic structure, that if you're drawing a picture plane, you have to give equal import to every part, not just the face bit, but the edge bit. And because if like one cell broke down on the picture plane, it would all cease to exist.
Right.
So it's contingent on a truth that came out of the theory of relativity. So it's applying that within spirituality, which is what they did essentially. That's what modified impressionism into post-impressionism, that consciousness. And I'm looking at Malevich as one of the, on a level with Einstein, as that degree of original thinking, that he was working at a similar level to that. And actually, I've got an article on firewalls in relation to black holes from Scientific American, which is a just a little experiment I've done, because I think a lot of contemporary art thinking, in a way, does parallel astrophysics and the thinking processes there. I'll show you, look, this is...
Bob is now showing me a sort of what looks like a solarized image.
Marcus got that from the movie. Isn't that great? It's like...
Is that you?
Yeah.
But that's you. I'm afraid you've
pixelated.
Got, yes, but I'm afraid you've got your right arm up, Bob.
That's right. Caught me on an off moment there, yeah. I'll tell you a funny story about that. I've got to tell you a funny story about that, but then I'll get on to what I wanted to say this time.
Okay.
This is in Leicester when the rugby, the South African... rugby team are over here playing Leicester, and you know, the various demonstrations against it at that time.
Oh yeah,
because of the all-white policy, and I saw the march coming this way, and the police the other way, and we were by a park area with grillings, and I saw the opportunity to stand on the grillings and stand up and shout, knowing that the police wouldn't break their ranks to get me because they were you know, advancing to the thing, so it was quite safe to do.
Yeah.
And then someone said you were on the news, you know, like headlining the news.
Yeah.
But what I said, I got it the wrong way around. I said down with the blacks, up with the whites, and I should have said up with the whites, up with the blacks, down with the. Yeah. I got it the wrong way. That's probably why I made. And it's just of that order. It just came into my head.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose you could have put both fists up and sort of shouted right. up with the blacks and whites.
No, I don't know. I don't support black, white people. A lot of morons, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
Culturally, sorry. Well,
just being democratic.
No, I'm not democratic.
Oh,
that's
you're
a
not?
Dirty word in Leningrad, democracy.
Right.
It's not appreciated. Shall I get up to where I got up to
yes,
and see?
Carry on.
See what time it is. Oh, yeah. Got a bit of time. Let's see how we go.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I was up to the paradoxical technique in which decorative lacework of fine lines is superimposed on a painterly background. This is Gustave Moreau, the way that he took what he did. He did history painting, which was, you know, something quite formal and boring and conservative. But he gave it, what's the word, multicultural thing. So he didn't obey any of the rules, but he was a very reactionary teacher. But again, on the other hand, he taught Matisse, and Gruot was his project. So it's very open at the same time. Moreau's sought to synthesize Delacroix and anger at that big competition between the line versus colour. So he tried to bring the two together. I won't go into that. His abstracts. Art are compositional studies to fix the values of colour masses constituting a picture's abstract structure as the pictorial structure that underlies figuration. So basically what he was doing was bringing in abstraction as a structural device. This was the advent of, you know, so of abstraction. Conceptually it was being eased as underpinning figuration, and then later it came to supersede figuration, because like the idea of what the guy said before, my voice is a horse, it's a flat, Maurice Lennis, flat surface covered in colour in a certain order. So it underpins that sort of thing. And when the impressionists pushed the picture plane out beyond the edge of the picture, so it extended it infinitely, then it wasn't the canvas anymore, but it was the whole environment that kind of got pulled in, i.e. life, reality, became the focus. So that was the move. And it was that sort of spillover that Moreau, you know, he wasn't that way himself, but he was responsible for it because of his originality, basically. So that's why I'm arguing Malevich straight back to Moreau, because I think I'm bypassing.
Are you the first person to bring this connection, draw this connection?
As far as I know,
because they were both. Moreau was a symbolist, wasn't he? He's classified as a symbolist.
Yeah, it's a spiritual thing. That
Malevich also apparently saw the eye of God in this black square. So is there something?
Somebody, also name at this conference, was saying she didn't agree with the symbolist links, but she acknowledged that there was a thought. So I got. So I didn't want to get into a conversation with her because it would polarise unusefully the conversation, so I didn't get engaged, because if you've got like such a sort of bloody-minded approach to that. But my interest is 100% spirituality, so I'm not the other way, and that you can only do if you completely believe in it, because belief isn't a thing you can't half believe or 99/100 believe. You've got to either believe it or not, and if you don't believe it, then that's fine. But if you believe it, then it will work because you believe it, rather than because of what it's about. Robert Creeley said people are hardwired to believe it. I mean, it doesn't matter what you believe in, just that you believe. The fact of, you know, say that the meaning of life is orange, or it's all a curtain hanging over the fire, or whatever it is, but it's a concept that you buy into. Cook concludes, this is a book he wrote on Gustave Moreau that I saw in the Musée Gustave Moreau is a permissive encyclopedic structure within which everything can coexist as a part of an overarching ensemble, which was Gustave Moreau's oeuvre. So it's basically this idea of everythingism, which Larionov brought in 1908, I think, you see the precedent here laying down. So it's his whole work is what an individual work is. It's a holistic, thing. So coming on to this thing, which, because I've got the, and I haven't got into reading, I just done a flip through, but there's a selective and collected writings of Malevich has just been published by £175, the Malevich Society and the Tate. And so this is quite a good thing. Malevich saw life as art. So that was his, I mean, he went into like science, he saw himself as a scientist basically, and not art as life, but life as art. So it's working with the totality. This is another aspect of his totalitarianism. Where his paintings can be construed as a form... Oh, this is Singer Sargent. Actually, he even comes into it. So where his paintings... There's a show on at the National Portrait Gallery. Where his paintings can be construed as a form of self-portraiture, where we are present when art is being created. So that's life as art in another way. So he's using the process of capturing his self-image as... or anything... as essentially self-portraiture, because I'm painting this room, but it's me who's painting it. So the reality of it is the me part of it, not what's being painted. So it's that, it's extending the ego. But why this whole thing, it's like, Christ, I put my arm there, there's something there. It's the thing of within the sort of Christianity of orthodoxy versus the Catholic thing and the... this Catholic mysticism against orthodox ritual, and one would accept the suffering of Christ and the other would say, no, the crucifixion was a great, wonderful day of success, so it wouldn't give a negative thing to it. So one identifies with suffering, the other identifies with glory. But essentially, they're the same thing. So there's a link there, and I've forgotten it. I'm sorry, but you might be able to make it up in here. Let me go on. Now, there's a UN report that 6 billion people have cell phones, where 4.5 people have flushing toilets. There's a little right. fact there.
Yeah.
Now, there's a book, Why the Internet Doesn't Work, that I'm sort of using as part of a reference. I'm only about halfway through it, so that's why I call this Volume 1, because I'm trying to...
How many volumes do you think there will be in
there? I don't know.
Endless.
Hopefully not, because I've got Inky Needles Press. Matt, he's going to publish it online, so I die, I want to get it, before it mutates into something else. Well, soon, actually. Kind of like these in Silicon Valley... creating vast, humble, in parentheses, empires based on memory and affect. Something harmless and safe as imaginary worlds of wonder. It's like being allowed to linger in someone's subconscious. So it's this idea of the active subconscious. A move away from ego-driven art. I won't go into that because it's... So it's basically... affect hasn't travelled so far in England, which is why kids were drawn to US consumerism. Anyway, I'll leave that as a thought. Now, St. Paul defines love, trusting, hoping... and persevering. It's kind of like a humble take on it. And I'm weaving into this, and this one another line I'm having is St. Isaac the Syrian, his ascetic homilies. The artist as a thinker attempts the important changes in society, who is also able to reflect on these changes in ways that eloquently address the complexity of our history and lived experience. This is Raphael Ragoff, the director at the Hayward. By making unexpected and provocative connections between objects and ideas, the artist now invites us to reconsider familiar notions of the past and thus change our view of the world that we live in today. So it's basically the artist as a paradigm shifter. Now, here's a little comment about Amazon, despoiled by Simon Head as the most egregiously ruthless corporation in America. And then I ask the questions, where do brains go when they go? Obviously, with Generation X's to senior moments, how does this differ from cyberspace? So, you know, I said I'm worried about having a senior moment. Well, where does my mind go when I have a senior moment? How does that differ from when the computer breaks down and you get messed up in cyberspace? Mm-hmm. I just was thinking about that. There are our dreams, what we can become out of nothing in our imagination. Something for nothing. This is the ascendances of Moreau's inner reality. It means life is very tough if you're poor. It means the internet is not the answer. And a social network isn't a social space. Social media businesses represent an aggressive expansion of capitalism into our personal relationships. An internet of everyone is inevitable. Now, my joy... All right, this is... I'll say it. Look, I'm not going to finish this, even this. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry about this, because I slowed down a little bit, but I had it... I was worried, you know, I didn't have enough to say, as we always do.
Oh, no,
do,
you've got plenty there.
I've got too much.
Another 10 programmes.
Okay. Now, right, this is what happened, just to give an idea from everyday experience, and I'm bringing it down to that. On my jog through the forest this morning, this is the New Forest, I saw a yelping dog fiercely pursuing a terrified stag or deer, and it crossed my path. Away down the track, I came upon someone standing with an emptyish lead, and I told him about this shameful incident I'd just encountered of the live pursuit, in fear of his life, really. And the guy said, you know that's my dog. And I said, no, I'd got no idea. And then a half a mile or so down, I was overtaken by a runner, keen to share events. I sped up to his speed, and I couldn't get him involved because he was so much into his running and the seriousness of it. He said, yes, it's a lovely day, isn't it? I was just trying this guy with this dog, and yes, bye. I got on there, drawn into conversation, an abstract. Okay, then at the entrance to the enclosure, a woman, again with an unleashed dog, a little poodle this time, heard my whole story. But instead of personalizing, she was very entertaining. She unleashed a dog, seemed to trivialise the whole thing, and hadn't listened to a single word that I said. So it was like the idea behind what I was saying, I was trying to communicate, and I just realised everyone's just completely out to lunch as far as mind goes. You know. And that was just like an everyday thing. You say something, and they're not listening. You know, no. They're not listening to the meaning. So I saw the Vakhtangov State Academic Theatre of Russia, which is, I mean, since I saw... it was the guy Abramovich had bought over this company, and I can't remember the name. It was at the Novokal Theatre. It was Ginsberg's Into the Whirlwind, but they did Chekhov as well. But it was like a 50-piece ensemble, 3 or 4 years rehearsal, where everyone was acting. It was just sublime. So I've got to go to see this. I paid a lot of money, £100 for a seat. And it's Pushkin's novel, Eugene Onegin, as... it's like a prose poem, but he's adapted it to a play.
Yeah.
It's the beauty of the human soul in pursuit of love and harmony. That's all I got. Isn't it? Pushkin himself said that modernity is very close to vulgarity, to ignorance and mediocrity, which I'm trying to say with this story, with this dog. And I am much afraid of the past. I am confident that the theatre is the territory of peace. And its mission to bring beauty to the people and add harmony to their lives, to resist sarcasm, cynicism and destruction, and the destruction of modern times. And then there was a little programme on the Radio 4 about neuroscience and having a library of the soul being assembled for future generations. Apparently there's like about 50 electromagnetic points in the brain or something, and somehow they can pick up images of people's thoughts. It's beginning in neuroscience to actually get that. So the idea then is to get a cinema of like they've got DNA records of everyone's cellular composition, a similar one of people's literal dreams and stuff like that. And that would be, as they may assemble a library of souls, basically. So that's one aspect. Now, I'm talking about the physiocrats and Adam Smith. And they believe that value comes from the land alone. And it was... his book, this is Adam Smith, because he can swing either way, like socialists like him and capitalists like him, Hume liked him. His book was a violent attack on the mercantile system of England in terms of colonisation, developments on the American front proves its point. I think that was the, what was it called, the libertarianism and that sort of thing, that he was, you should have a free trade system against the spirit of cooperation to defraud the public, performing a useful function, but because of that, beware of them when they get together, an overgrown standing army of special interests. So we're going to see the rise of corporate capitalism in the
trans- Are you going to vote this year?
Labour. You always vote Labour.
Do you?
Because regardless of who's representing it, because anything else is, you know, is basically, in my interpretation, is middle class. I mean, do you know who the biggest beneficiaries of charity are? Did I tell you that last week?
I think you told me last time.
Middle class people.
Yeah. But how does that tap into Labour?
Well, they're not. They wouldn't. What? I mean, they're not. I mean, I like Gordon Brown.
Yeah.
You know, because what he did is pure socialism. And, you know, it became a dirty word, didn't it?
Do you think that Tony Blair was a socialist?
Well, up to the point of, what's this thing called, this Iraq war, which he lost me. No, I was quite liked him. Yeah,
did
right.
you?
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, obviously, he's a revisionist. I mean, he's having to shape the cloth to fit the body,
was,
so to speak.
I think it was Will Self last night on the TV said he was sort of more right-wing than Thatcher.
Yeah, but he was basically at heart Labour. So it's not right-wing or left-wing, because I've heard... Stalin described as right wing, which, well, I mean, nothing's more stupid than that. I mean, what communism is left wing, it's not right wing. You can't mix metaphors to that degree.
It might be left wing in name, but in fact, it can be something else, can't it?
No.
I mean,
Michael Foote, and this is something I'd adhere to, always addressed or talked or discussed people on the strength of their arguments, i.e. what they were talking about, not what they were. So, for example, when Enoch Powell came out with the Rivers of Blood speech, you know, as fashion would have it, no one would talk to him except Michael Foote, because he said, well, he's a human being. He's not...
Well,
his
the
ideas...
Rivers of Blood was apparently a quote anyway from something else.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a complete moron, whatever. You know,
I wouldn't call him a moron.
No, I would.
Okay.
I just did.
Yeah. He was a brilliant man in his own way. I mean, he wasn't...
I wouldn't defend him in any way.
Wouldn't you?
No, absolutely not. No, I'm not. But no, what he did, he was saying, no, he's a human being first, and that he needs, before any ideas, you know, people live before they have ideas, and he's got it in perspective, sort of thing. So similarly, what Labour stands for isn't the way that it's carried out. I would stand for, I would do it on principle, whoever it is, because otherwise, like, that's why I'm a pacifist, because I don't believe in touching people. I had been up to my life. I didn't touch anyone for about 30 or 40 years after Robert Ellis. I punched him in the stomach and I was taken to the head teacher's office and I thought, this is stupid.
Yeah.
And I became a pacifist because I believe you can say anything to anybody because they're words, but don't touch them, because there's something in touching.
Touching in any way?
In any way. You have to be very careful.
But I've known you hug people.
Yeah, no, this is since then. This is since, you know, I'm the black, you know, American and all that sort of thing. Up to that point, I wouldn't touch people anyway, because I wasn't sure what the vibes were. So you're running the risk every time you touch someone of transmitting a negative magnetic force or whatever it is. Anyhow, that's my sort of belief. So, for example, I was in Watts with Mum and Dad, you know, and I said, if someone comes up with a knife or a gun, I'm not going to do anything to save your life. I'll shout and swear, but I won't do anything physical, because it's a thing, like, that's why I'm a pacifist. You know, if two people don't fight, there's no fight. Basically, it's as simple as that, you know. If you don't accept physicality, I mean, I know it's an extreme point of view, but it's, and in that sense, that's why I'm bringing it back to the idea of ideas. attack someone from what it stands for rather than as it's practiced. It's just easier. It's simple. And that's what I tend to do. That's why I'd support Labour, because, you know, I trust someone, in even if they're raving, you know, Jack Straws or something, you know, still they're Labour. And the heart, their soul, is in working class consciousness rather than middle class or privileged.
You're saying you're a socialist then?
I am, yeah. Or communist, really.
Well, exactly. But would you not then prefer to vote for something, you know, like the Socialist Workers' Party?
They're Trotskyists. I wouldn't dream that.
But isn't that socialism rather than the Labour?
Bullshit. That's
Labour
middle class.
Is just middle of the road,
Marx
attacked, right-wing.
Marx
sort of
attacked Trotsky as being, I've never heard such a, he's a socialist utopian. I mean, that's the worst form of despicable life. And that's really, it's just, it's a flowering egoist.
So you're in favour of the status quo? Then,
yeah,
you are.
I think so. What does that mean?
you like things the way they are. You don't want to have any change, really.
Well, I would be more. I'm more Chinese. There's this quote, because there was a guy actually on this conference on abstraction society, because it brings in multicultural elements, and he was saying about the word. It's a word that the West use that they don't have a word for in China. Or they do, but it doesn't mean anything like it. And I can't remember what it was now. But anyway, the point being, my favourite quotes, which are one of the things that it's like Chinese song or tang, life is like a galloping horse, twisting and changing at every turn and every hour. What can man do, or what can he not, except allow his own decomposition to continue? And then there's like an image of a Chinese, well, a Western romantic poet plucking a rose from a bush and giving it to him, whereas the sage, Chinese sage, would leave it there and write a poem and give the poem. He wouldn't mess around with nature. You know, you can coexist with it, but don't. So in that sense, I am.
You are what?
Whatever you said the word was. Status quo.
You're in favour of the status quo.
It seems the way they are.
You don't want to change things, so you vote Labour.
Not that aspect of things, yeah. But not in the sense that David Hume was status quo, say, i.e. whatever you're born in is your lot. That was where he was coming from, and I wouldn't go along with, because I would oppose that. I would say that, you know, things like, from that point, I'm an anarchist in as much as I believe that property is theft, you know, that. But I don't, as Kropotkin said, he said that that doesn't mean that. It just means that, you know, within sort of common sense bounds, you apply it, you know, as a principle. Right. Or Jesus Christ was a good, you know, comic. You know, the things he said, like trying to stuff a camel through the eye of a needle. It's a funny image, you know. Right. So it's just, you know, unusual image. It's more about the idea they're trying to communicate.
It would be nice
than
if the Labour politicians came out with something like that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, it's time. There's still time, isn't it?
I mean, they're just like a bunch of bank managers, really, aren't they?
They've become that. Yeah, it's a shame, really, but they just lost all self-confidence. It's a working class thing. It's basically an inferiority complex of working class people that bloody Tories are working on continually. Yeah. My grandfather, who was a union on my dad's side, said that show a working class person a bit of red meat and they'll fall for it. You know, that, you know, you can just... They're gullible as shit, you know, sort of, excuse me, as hell.
Or the working class, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, right. That's very cynical.
Well, yeah. That's a stalwart kind of brothers unite kind of stance.
Is it?
Yeah. That's what we're up against.
Sounds like the opposite to me, but anyway.
We might do, yeah. Right. I don't know how far I'm going to get. What have we got to? In short view, as free trade proponents, the philosophical systems for law ruling, not men or gay. If traces of black life had been removed from the British past to ensure that blacks are not a part of the British future, having been born here and following a line of moderation, it was just this idea of... someone has said something about black people... not being part of the British future, and I'm sort of get this is like an overriding theme. I just say this bit because I just read it. It's not very interesting, but I'll read it. My pathway has always been subversion, as I've shunned the process of developing skills in this area because it's a phony identity, and have been able to avoid the latter through quickness of mind. So in considering subversion, it's always open to perception, the perception of extremism and being counterculture, which in turn tends to be labelled outsider art. I've managed to pull myself up past this particular closed door and am finding myself on the threshold of mainstream recognition. The obvious ones here are identity with the hang-ups associated with celebrity status. But to best avoid the pitfalls, an almost religiously humble rigour is helpful, the stance of a saint, without it necessarily accompanying suffering. But a suffering or spiritual path is not necessarily to be rejected as a composite of the healthy lifestyle and a vital ingredient, indistinguishable from the sense of involvement or the process itself. I guess at this stage, the resolution is to unconditionally identify with process, and this is where totalitarianism fits in. I can't see any substantive difference between the two approaches. Of course, I could well be wrong, but applying Robert Creeley's perception, which I've told, we need to believe in something. At this point of in my life, I can easily live with this construct. Fin de siècle thinking seems to encourage divergent voices. It's a series of pastiches. And then I go on about Stravinsky's Firebird and Pekka Salonen's performance of it, showing how much unexpressed potential lies latent within Fin de siècle aesthetics, because he brought out a whole different meaning of Feuerbach, and you know, he just approached him in a different way. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's sort of locked in inside that, and this is what I'm basically beginning to bring out. I let me just read a little bit more, and then we finish off with that.
We've got a few minutes
jazz.
Left. We can finish with the jazz. Which try? Okay, the first try.
Yeah, but I should just
say you have been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with this week's recurring guest, Bob Parks, who has a film coming out. You've got a documentary about you being...
Coming up in the spring. It might be summer now.
And possibly shown on BBC Four, eventually.
Yeah, it will be shown on BBC Four. Okay. There's just one point I wanted to make on, and then we get into... track 12.
Sure.
Just it. Daniel Kalms, who was a friend of Malevich, who he wrote this novel about this, his elderly mother in her 90s, cruelly dying across the floor, and that was what the whole thing was about. Anyhow, Daniel Kalms reported Malevich in 1927 as saying, "The main thing in art is to stop." Now I've got a little bit here. What Malevich means when he was saying to stop is to stop until we have realised what we have before we give it away without even knowing we have it.
So who is this, Bob? This is a track by...
Montana Roberts.
Yeah.
Coin, Chapter 3, River Run Thee. It's just the last one I wanted to play. But it's basically freeform jazz. What it's devolved into, I think it's really interesting.
The illegal slave trade. Come the illegal away, slave trade. And the so-called legal traders slave trade. Come away with me. Come away. Fellow wants me, said as he swam away from the side, so going after him I persuaded him that the fellow was in the boat and induced him to return and get on board again. He became so delirious that on my waking up I found him getting into the water.